This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live here at St. Vitale Center in the Food Hall. It's the Toy Mountain Charity Toy Drive in support of the Salvation Army. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Ezra Ginsberg on my left, Richard Pollock on my right. I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Oh, there's we got a whole hockey team right here beside us.
We got some future stars here.
You got a whole hockey team. Dancing Gabe was down here a couple minutes ago. So we got a whole...
Maybe we'll have one of these superstars on the
air. Yeah, we got to get one of these superstar kids on the air. Absolutely. And nobody wants to listen to what any of us have to say.
Look, Drew, you're not a superstar.
Look at them. They all brought great toys down. So this is terrific. We're down here at St. Vitale Center Food Hall. If you want to join in, by all means, come over here. Drop us off a new unwrapped toy. There's a chance to enter in the raffles to win a bunch of different great prize packages. And we got a lot of fun going down here at St. Vitale Center. Where are the kids going? I thought we were having the kids
going on 103.
They're going. We got bumped.
I think we got bumped.
I don't know.
I'm going to have to talk to Ace Burpee about this.
Yeah, I think Ace is probably playing a power play here. Pardon the pun, as it were.
Come on, this is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Are you saying that Ace needs to go on the Jets power play for it to improve? Is that what you're saying, Drew?
That'll be next week's segment, I think. Let's talk about some contract signings from around the NHL this week. We'll talk about the Oilers next segment. And after that, at the top of the hour, we'll be joined by Dave Jamieson from our affiliate TSN 1260 in Edmonton. Montreal Canadiens, they signed forward Brendan Gallagher to a six-year contract extension, reportedly worth $22.5 million. You know, your thoughts on Brendan Gallagher as a player and your thoughts on the contract that gives him slightly under $4 million per year.
I think it gives him a really good, it gives him the security for a guy like Gallagher. He wants to sign long-term with this squad, and he knows who's going to be there long-term, right? He knows Max Pacioretty is going to be there through 2018-19. He knows P.K. Subban's going to be there for the long-term, for the real long-term, as long as they can possibly sign him to. Alexei Yamalin is on the books there. Lars Eller. So there's a core there. He knows, he knows who's going to be on this team and how competitive they're going to be, right? He knows they're going to be a winning team, because if you look at it, Carey Price, 6.5 for another 3.5 years. When you have Price and Subban and Pacioretty locked up, you know what you're getting into. It's not like you're signing with a team and you're saying, okay, I'll sign for 3 years, let's see where we're at. You're saying, I'm signing long-term because I like where I am, I feel comfortable with the organization has put a lot into me, and I think we're going places. And the 3.75 cap hit, Drew, you look at it, well, it's not going to be more than Pacioretty, who's a steal at 4.5, but that's when you get that internal structure, right?
Sure, internal salary structure, internal salary cap sort of thing.
Like, Gallagher can't say, not that he's worth it, but the idea, I want more than Pacioretty, I want 4.67. Well, you're just not better than Pacioretty, right? And you're a different player. So Gallagher's going to be able to give them the right winger on the second line, third line, wherever they want to play him. You're going to have a competitive game from him every single time out. He's going to go to the net. He's going to play a heart and soul guy. He'll get you your 20 goals, 25 assists kind of thing. Maybe a little more than that. I like the signing. I like locking a guy like that up. A heart and soul guy in the room too, long term. And I don't think he's the type of player. I don't think Subban is either, or Price or Pacioretty, any of them, that is going to take their foot off the pedal once they sign a long-term deal.
Ezzy, your thoughts on the Gallagher contract?
Brendan Gallagher is one of, you guys know this, he's one of my favorite players in the NHL. He's a little ball of hate. He's like me, he's 5'9".
And that's where the similarities end.
The guy, he's a little bit better at hockey than I am, just a little bit. I mean, I can put some pucks in the net too, but no, Brendan Gallagher is a great hockey player. He was excellent for the Habs last year in the playoffs. And this is a guy, you mentioned Richie, he's played a lot with Plekanec and Alex Galchenyuk, who they came into the NHL at the same time. Excellent hockey player. Great contract. To me, Brendan Gallagher's a guy, he'll spend the rest of his career with the Montreal Canadiens, I imagine. They love him there. Michel Therrien loves him. Richie's the salary cap expert as far as the terms go, but as far as locking him up, I like it. And as a hockey player, You would love to have him on your team. He's tough to play against. He's a good guy in the corners. He's a good guy in the power play. He scored 8 power play goals for the Habs last year. As I mentioned, last year in the playoffs, he was a key player for them to get to the Eastern Conference Finals. So I think that I saw that contract, and I thought it made 100% sense. And he's a guy that again, I think, you know, he's one of my favorite players to watch. Small guy with a big heart.
Well, you know, he's also signing off of an entry-level deal. It's weird to think he's only on his entry-level contract right now, but he is. So yep. What that means, he has 4 years left before he's an unrestricted free agent. And if you're a UFA after 4 years, that means you have 2 UFA years in this 6-year deal. So what would he have? He wouldn't have had arbitration rights this year, and we've seen that with, you know, bridge contracts with Subban and such. And the Habs are saying, we don't want to go down that road with the bridge contract with Gallagher here. We like what we have. We know what we're getting. We don't need to challenge him anymore. And Subban certainly rose to the challenge, and I thought received a contract that was warranted. They're saying, okay, we're going to buy out a couple UFA years. We're going to give you a little bit more of a higher number now than you would have got. And both sides are happy. Security is there for the Habs. At the end of the contract, the Habs are certainly going to be getting value. And Gallagher gets security knowing he's got a 6-year deal, and he's going to get a little more money up front. So I think both sides win here.
You know, Drew, I think, you know, this is important to mention. Brendan Gallagher was a 5th-round pick in 2010.
Sure.
So, I mean, this isn't a guy that was a top-10 pick and all that. I mean, Galchenyuk was obviously a top-5 pick. Was he 3rd overall? He was high. Forget exactly where he went.
Galchenyuk was 3rd, I believe. Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about a guy, and, you know, there have been, you know, some articles written about Brendan Gallagher. This is a guy that just works his butt off, and I love that about him. Nothing was given to him. He's a good junior player, but he was a guy that, you know, has worked to where he's gotten, and now he's a key part of that Montreal Canadiens team.
And I've taken issue with, and you guys, we've talked about it on the show before, I've taken issue with the TJ Brody contract and the Jonas Brodin contract. I think those are both bad contracts by the player and the agent.
Right.
And, well, bad in terms of, I think they could have got a lot more money. Different here, because a guy like Gallagher is not going to be your top-line right winger. He's not going to go into pre-agency and just absolutely make a boatload of money. But if a guy like TJ Brody or Jonas Brodin hit UFA status, they're going to run to the bank and take as much money as they want. So it's different here. I think this is a reasonable one for both sides.
Let's move down to St. Paul, Minnesota, where the Wild signed Marco Scandella to a 5-year contract extension. 5 years, $20 million, $4 million per season is his salary cap hit. Marco Scandella is a player. Is he $4 million a good number for him?
Well, again, ask Richie, because he's the one that is better to analyze these things. Drew, I would take, $5 to play in the NHL. It seems like a good contract. I mean, I can only speak to Marco Scandella as a defenseman, and, you know, he's an underrated defenseman, in my opinion. And you look at the Minnesota Wild, I know Ryan Suter's had, I think he's had the mumps as well. He's had some issues there, but, you know, Ryan Suter plays half the game. And you talk about that defense pairing with Jonas Brodin, who Richie just mentioned in his contract, but Marco Scandella and Jared Spurgeon have been the second pair there now for 3 years, and it's a good pair. It's not a pair that's going to maybe jump out as far as having crazy offensive statistics, but he's a guy that, you know, he's a good defenseman, and, you know,
Spurgeon's a good offensive player.
Yeah, and you look at that contract, Richie, and now who they have locked up. And the Minnesota, Chuck Fletcher's done a nice job, Richie, of locking up that top 4D for them. And you look at Minnesota, and they might be out of the playoff picture now, but come playoff time, I wouldn't be surprised if they're in the playoffs.
I think they'll be there.
I'd be shocked if they weren't in the playoffs. That's how highly I think of this team. Drew, I don't know a ton about Marco Scandella, so I don't want to break that down too much in terms of his skill set. I do know, as you mentioned, he is a guy who plays alongside Jared Spurgeon, and they've really secured their top four there. So I can speak more to that. And Brodin, Suter, and Scandella signed long-term. Spurgeon on the books for this year and next year at 2.6. I love what Chuck Fletcher is doing in terms of retaining the talent and the core that he has there. And you look at Ryan Suter, he's at 7.5, guys, right? I know he signed.
It's a bargain.
Yeah, 7.5. Scandella at 4, and Brodin at 4.1. I mean, whatever Spurgeon ends up re-signing for, I assume that'll eventually happen, because he's an RFA after next year. You're going to have your top four locked up there, and it's going to be under probably $20 million. That allows you to bring in Vanek. That allows you to bring in other players. You know, I don't love Thomas Vanek, but he should be able to get you 50, 60 points in his sleep.
Yeah.
And that allows you to do different things.
Might be hard this year, Richie.
Well, have the flexibility, right? He should be able to, as he doesn't mean he will for sure. But that's what I – so he's locking these guys up long-term. And not only that, but the guys who have played together for a long time. I think that's important. You're seeing some success with a lot of these teams who have a lot of continuity, right? Chicago and different teams like that. So I think that Scandella playing behind a guy like Suter and Brodin, playing behind that pairing, he'll play against your second unit. From all accounts, he's a real good player, you know, and I think that you can't go wrong here. A $4 million contract, by the way. He's 5 years he's been in the league, eh? So he's got two more years till UFA status. He signs a five-year deal at $4 million. He's only got... So you're buying out 3 years here of UFA status for $4 million. I mean, most defensemen in the National Hockey League, if you can play top four, you'll get $4 million in your sleep. So I think, again, you're getting pretty good value here for the Wild. I don't know enough about Scandella as a player to say, oh, for sure, huge steal for the Wild, but it appears that the Wild are getting great value once again, which is a testament to Chuck Fletcher.
One last one, another defense signing in L.A., Alec Martinez, 6 years, $24 million, that same $4 million yeah. salary cap hit. Sort of similar conversation to what Scandella does, to what Martinez does?
Yes and no, Drew. Yeah, similar to an extent. You're looking at a left-side guy who's able to play in a role that, you know, moving the puck, obviously getting that game-winning goal last year. But, again, I don't know a ton about Alec Martinez. I know that when you're playing behind Drew Doughty and Slava Voynov and guys like Regier and Willie Mitchell in the past and Jake Muzzin, the pressure on you is not as high. The competition you're facing is not as good. But you're locking in at a very reasonable number. Jake Muzzin signed for that same $4 million number, right? So if you look at it that way, Martinez is also already 27. And he was on his three-year entry-level deal, then bridge contract. So you're buying out all UFA years. These are all UFA years that you're buying out here, and you're buying out at $4 million. So you're thinking of him as a guy who can step into your 3-4 number, 3-4 at a reasonable number, but you're happy to pay him that at 5-6 as well. That's what I would say.
Yeah, and Alec Martinez is a guy last year that for parts of the year couldn't get into the lineup.
Right.
And he really made up for himself in the playoffs there and towards the playoffs. Excellent defenseman, can move the puck. He's got offensive abilities. We've seen that. And, with the uncertainty guys surrounding Slava Voynov, we've seen the Kings get fined. They were fined because he wasn't supposed to be practicing with them. You guys saw that.
Yeah.
I know you saw that. And so, I mean, I think it's nice to get him locked up. As Richie mentioned, this is Drew Doughty's back end here. I mean, Drew Doughty is arguably the best defenseman in the NHL. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's a team right now that, you know, maybe they're not performing at top gear. There might be a little bit of a Stanley Cup hangover, but that doesn't really matter because the Kings turn it on in the playoffs. But I really like Alec Martinez's game. He's a good defenseman.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll then talk about the Edmonton Oilers. Craig McTavish spoke to the media yesterday in Edmonton. We'll talk about that. And then after him, Dave Jamieson from TSN 1260 in Edmonton. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live at St. Vitale Center. We're in the food hall in support of Toy Mountain and the Salvation Army.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
What's it going to take to get this group to the level of urgency that we need? And as I said before, there's got to be personnel changes and more competitive people brought in over time. But we need this group. And I want the group to know at the end of this that the emphasis is largely on them, and that includes the coaches, to try and get us to a level of play and performance that we can have success in the NHL.
Edmonton Oilers general manager Craig McTavish addressing the media yesterday in Edmonton.
Wow.
I mean, wow is right, Ezzy. I mean, we've seen how terrible the Oilers have been. They have not won in the Western Conference yet this year, which is amazing to say. Mm-hmm. They have not won in, I believe, 11 games in a row now after they lost to the Jets on Wednesday night. Craig McTavish, I mean, there's people clamoring for heads in Edmonton, fans, media, all alike are clamoring for people's heads. And Craig McTavish comes and doubles down on what they currently have. How surprised were you guys that was the message he decided to go with yesterday? That on top of, don't blame me, I've only been here for 18 months.
It was a very bizarre press conference, Drew. I don't know why it was held. I don't understand who would have made that decision, or if just McTavish makes that decision.
Richie, he wasn't talking to the media at all before that, by the way.
Right.
So he was refusing, and Jim Matheson, who has covered the team for many years, was writing about that. So I don't know if that has something to do with it.
I think the media pressure for sure has something to do with it. Ezzy, I think you're exactly right. And seeing McTavish in Winnipeg this week and how dejected he looked after the loss in the box upstairs there, they seem so lost as an organization. And again, I don't think we talk enough about the fact that the success or lack thereof of these teams lies very much from the top down. I know they brought in Bob Nicholson here to change things and work with Daryl Cates there, but how much power does Bob Nicholson have? And if Bob Nicholson has power, is he happy with the guys who are in place? Because it's always awkward when you're brought into a place with somebody with management already there and with the people who hired you having put the people in place that are there. So, because I think it starts at the top. You can't continue to fire coaches. You go from Pat Quinn, late Pat Quinn, unfortunately, to Tom Rennie, to Ralph Kruger, to Dallas Eakins. And
Ralph Kruger, Richie, wasn't there very long.
He was there for one season, and they had some signs of success on special teams and different things that you think, okay, he's doing a nice job with a young team, and they fire him. And they fire him, what, via Skype?
Yeah, via Skype.
The way things have been handled in Edmonton, McTavish was there for that, if I recall correctly, just so bizarre, and it starts from the top down, and the player, the team isn't good enough. And who puts the team together? The GM. And is it GM McTavish now, or is it Tambellini before, or has it always been Kevin Lowe? We don't know the answer to that. I suspect it's an answer. It's a bit of all three. But, I mean, Craig McTavish goes out this offseason. He signs Mark Fain, signs Benoit Pouliot, brings in Teddy Purcell.
Nikita Nikitin.
I mean, come on. I thought a lot of those acquisitions were certainly blown out of proportion there. Success hasn't been there, and I think there needs to be changes at the top before we talk about another move, the coach, or another trade, or anything else. And I don't think there will be, frankly.
Craig McTavish wasn't shy about throwing some of his players under the bus during that press conference yesterday. Here's what he had to say about Jordan Eberle and Taylor Hall.
Jordan Eberle's got to be a voice in our leadership group. He's got to be demanding more of the team. Taylor's got to be demanding more of the team. And when you start demanding more of the team, it has a residual effect in your decision-making on the ice.
Ezzy, what do you think about a general manager calling out individual players in the media like that?
Have you guys ever seen this or heard this before, this type of press conference? I mean, that was bad.
He looked nervous, too.
It's bad in Edmonton, guys. I mean, Edmonton's getting a top 3 or 4 pick this year.
Which is embarrassing.
Like, I mean, this team has not beaten a Western Conference team yet. They're in the Western Conference.
It's amazing to say, isn't it?
We're 28, 29 games into the season here. And, you know, Craig McTavish is calling out his players, as Richie mentioned, bizarre. But to me, it doesn't smell right. It doesn't look right. You know, Richie talks about kind of the power structure there in Edmonton. You know, Bob Nicholson, Richie, who I was under the impression was going to kind of be more of a business, just handle the business aspect of, you know, what's going on with the new arena and stuff like that. Is he involved in, you know, the player personnel decisions? The signings that the Oilers made just weren't good signings. Mark Fain was an expendable defenseman for the New Jersey Devils.
A team with not a lot of defensive depth.
Nikita Nikitin is a bottom-pairing defenseman. Well, I mean, a good, solid defensive defenseman.
He's a bottom-pairing at most.
He's not a guy that, back to McTavish's comments, okay? I mean, we could talk all day about what the Edmonton Oilers don't have. But, you know, he's calling out Jordan Eberle, Taylor Hall. What kind of message does that send to the players are listening to that?
Well, let me ask you guys this. They don't play again until Sunday. And then I think they have Anaheim twice and San Jose twice.
I think it's San Jose twice, four losses.
Yeah. Well, that should be 4 losses. And so let's say they get to 15 games in a row without winning. Yeah. And he just had this press conference and he said there's not any changes coming. Well, if you lose your next 4 games to teams, you know, you should lose to, can you still say there aren't any changes coming, that this core is good enough?
I just don't understand why you say there aren't any changes coming when at the end of the day, if somebody makes you an offer you can't refuse for Jordan Eberle, you're going to make the deal, right? Isn't that in the best interest of the team?
Well, the
irony, how would you say that? I mean, I just don't understand.
The irony of the comment is when he was hired as general manager 18 months ago, what was the first thing he said in the press conference? There's going to be radical changes quickly under with me as a general manager.
What's Craig McTavish's experience as a general manager?
Well, I don't think there's any, really, is there?
It's since his playing career, Richie, it's coaching. I mean, it's coaching, and that is an issue, I believe, as outsiders looking at this, whether it's us in the media or fans or in the hockey world, whatever, you've got the old boys club there.
Daryl
Cates has let the old boys club run the team.
Because he idolized them when he was younger.
And the problem is...
And he's making money.
They aren't going anywhere. I mean, they got a new arena there, and I mean, I can't imagine how depressed the Oilers fans are.
Well...
But I mean, looking at it, you're saying like you've got all of these first over, like Neil. I know Richie disagrees a little bit, but to me, like Neil Yakupov, I mean, he just looks awful, and that's a first overall pick you have on your roster there, and he just looks uninspired. He's not scoring, and I mean, aside from Taylor Hall, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Jordan Eberle, and a few other guys. I mean, this just isn't a very good roster.
But even those players, Ezzy, I mean, how effective have they been, and how effective are they in buying into having to be able to play defense as well? I mean, stupid decisions, lack of back-checking, lack of overall caring, I think, for all zones in the ice. I don't see anything there.
It's one of the biggest messes I've ever seen in the NHL in recent memory. It really is.
It's hard to be that bad when you have high-end talent like that. And don't get me wrong, if you want to get into a breaking down of the roster, you're talking about a defense problem again, like Colorado. They can't get the puck out of their own zone. But this problem is different than Colorado's in that it goes way higher up.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll bring in Dave Jamieson from our TSN radio affiliate in Edmonton to talk more about that press conference and more about the woeful Edmonton Oilers. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live at St. Patel Center. We're in the food hall in support of Toy Mountain and the Salvation Army on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. We're live at the St. Patel Center Food Hall. It's the Toy Mountain Charity Toy Drive in support of the Salvation Army. Alongside Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from our TSN radio affiliate, TSN 1260 in Edmonton, Dave Jamieson. Dave, good afternoon. Welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm very good. Good to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us, Dave. Obviously brought you on to talk about the Oilers and the Craig McTavish press conference from yesterday. In the city of Edmonton, how did that press conference go over with the fans?
Not particularly well. I think there was an expectation, and let me preface that. There was an expectation from, I think, a vast majority of fans who were hoping for McTavish to walk to a podium and announce that there would be either a coaching change or that, you know, there was a significant trade. That was quite unlikely, to be quite honest with you, given the state of the Oilers. I mean, everyone wanted that. They wanted to see someone walk the plank. And so on that level, McTavish disappointed them. But, you know, when you sort of sit back and reflect on where this team is right now, where it has been, and hopefully where it is going, you know, McTavish was there to preach patience. Not sure that there are many fans out there that buy into that, right? Because it has gotten to the point now where even the most optimistic Oiler fan would be hard-pressed to say, yeah, the future, you know, if these guys, you know, the two or three or four, however many core young players develop the way they anticipate, then the future might look good. But this is a team with a lot of holes in it and holes in critical positions. Center ice is a glaring weakness. Mm-hmm. Goaltending is highly questionable. They lack at this point a stud defenseman. We could go on, but I think you get the point.
Now, Dave, you talk about preaching patience, and
If you're an Oilers fan, I know McTavish is a new general manager and Steve Tambellini was there before, but if you still see Kevin Lowe and a lot of the same guys who've been there for so long, are the Oilers fans just sick of hearing patience, not only because they haven't been winning, but they're hearing it from the guys who've already put them into this position?
Absolutely they are. Kevin Lowe, you know, if there was a sort of a food chain of people that the Oiler fan wants to blame, I would suggest that while I don't necessarily agree with it, given his current role in the organization, the fact that Kevin Lowe has been through here through all of it makes him the most obvious person that fans would like to have a bullseye attached to. The owner takes criticism because he is the guy who pays for all of this and has put all of these people in place, or most of them, and the you know, because of Lowe's relationship, friendship, if you will, with Daryl Cates, many people feel that that gives him some sort of diplomatic immunity to, you know, to continue to be a part of this and continue to fail. All of that said, you know, there have been, what, four head coaches here, so I think on McTavish's, since McTavish came on the job, there have been 14 new players that have been hustled through this lineup, and some of them have been, you know, not successful. And there have been a few, you know, what you would call good additions. David Perron last year, that was a good deal with St. Louis for Magnus Pjärvi. And then you've had Boyd Gordon and Matt Hendricks. I mean, good role players. Every team needs those guys. But I think, you know, the Oil fan sits back and goes, but how come we've had all these number one draft picks or first round draft, highly coveted players, and it hasn't made a difference? We haven't been able to really grow our own goaltender and they invested years in Devin Dubnyk only to trade him for Matt Hendricks. Ben Scrivens and Victor Foss are probably fine on a level, but to be quite candid, I mean, they're both of them didn't come to Edmonton as number one goaltenders. I mean, they were complementary pieces in the other teams they played in. And if they had success, it was limited. And so Edmonton rolled the dice on that this year, and it's largely has not worked out. So, I mean, it's, I think, you know, to go back to your question, yes, people are tired of hearing patience from most of the same people, and they also tar McTavish with the same brush,
right?
Because he was here obviously as a player, he was the coach, he left the organization, stepped away, he coached in the, you know, the Chicago Wolves, and but is still seen as one of the boys on the bus, right? That link back to that glorious era in Oiler hockey. And I, you know, it's not his fault that he was part of that, but I am personally a McTavish fan, I think, in the sense that, you know, I think as a coach he was far outside of Glenn Sather, maybe the best his franchise has had, and as a player I had a lot of respect for him, and I think he's, you know, he's well regarded, but right now people just don't want to hear what they're selling.
You know, Dave, when you watch Craig McTavish at the press conference yesterday, for me he always seems like a pretty polished speaker, and for the most part, just my personal observation, yesterday he seemed very nervous and he was scripted, and he was looking down at his notes and going point by point. Was that very uncharacteristic from your perspective of what Craig McTavish mostly presents?
Well, you know, that's an excellent point, and it was one that's echoed by people who were there. My producer, I was not at Rexall Place yesterday. My producer was there, and a number of other people who I spoke with following the news conference said much the same thing. Now, that would have been a pressure cooker situation for Craig McTavish to walk into, but as you say, like, he has been as a coach, as an executive, you know, one thing you could always see, for whether you liked what he was saying, he was poised, he could be reassuring, and certainly very good on his feet dealing with the back and forth with the media. But, you know, it was a controlled situation. The reporters were allowed to ask one question, no follow-up, and you know, and the Oiler PR department certainly did their job, and I think did it well in the sense of, you know, protecting the general manager. He stepped before the media, and I think that was the right move, to because somebody needed to say something now before they step back on the ice to play San Jose tomorrow night at home. Somebody had to get out in front of this, and for for lack of a better description, fall on the grenade. Now, you know, my takeaway from all of yesterday, well, there were two things. One was McTavish clearly has, and he was pretty good at this during his playing career, he blocked a shot. He took a bunch of shots, and he deflected and bobbed and weaved, which is fine. And because I don't think he has answers. The other thing was, if I'm one of the Oilers scouts, pro scout or amateur scout, I might start polishing my resume.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Dave Jamieson from our TSN radio affiliate, TSN 1260 in Edmonton, talking about the Oilers and Craig McTavish's press conference yesterday.
Yeah, Dave, and we played that press conference before we had you on, and in that press conference, you had Craig McTavish calling out Jordan Eberle and Taylor Hall, and my question for you as far as that goes is, do you think that, I guess, the lack of leadership from those young star players, how big of an issue is that, I guess?
I think bigger than we know, and you're probably, you and your listeners are aware of Andrew Ferentz after the loss to Arizona, where the Oilers looked absolutely deplorable. I mean, they were abysmal on so many levels, and they did it at home. Ferentz, following the game, said that, and I'm paraphrasing, that there are a lot of people moping around this dressing room. They don't maybe appreciate what it means to play in the National Hockey League, and quoting here, he said it's a joke. So, what that, you know, that response by Ferentz, those comments by Ferentz, what it pointed up was what we may have, what the Oilers may have in that locker room is a division between, and this isn't uncommon, you've got a young core of players, the stars, if you will, the young stars, the future of the franchise, and Taylor Hall, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Jordan Eberle to a degree, although, you know, he certainly for now is very much part of that. Maybe Justin Schultz, although he is going backwards as fast as he rose in the NHL during the lockout shortened season. Justin Schultz is receding into the background in terms of his play at the NHL level. Well, it magnified that what you've got here is a divide. You've got Andrew Ferentz, who, you know, is in his second year with the Oilers. He's the captain. He wears the C, and I understand why he has it, given that he came from a Stanley Cup champion Boston Bruin team. He is well-respected. He speaks well. I mean, he has a lot of the qualities you would want in your captain, but he is... he's closer to the end of his career than he is the beginning, okay? And you've got this young group who probably are feeling like, hey, this is our team, for better or worse. But other than Taylor Hall, who is the logical next captain of this team, I don't think, you know, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, no, he is not there, not nearly there. And Jordan Eberle, you know, he's one of those players offensively gifted and can dazzle and tantalize, but if he's not doing that and contributing in that way, he's a passenger. And so you're left with this void. And then you have a lot of, frankly, you know, jersey fillers in a lot of the rest of the positions. Guys, a rotating cast of characters who come in and out on defense. I think, there is a leadership void, if you will, a gulf right now. And I mean, I'm not in the dressing room, so I can't speak to what, you know, what Taylor Hall may do on a day-to-day basis, but his abilities would lead you to believe in the style of play and the fact, you know, that he will be or should be that leader. But he's not right now, apparently. He is wearing an A, but he's not wearing the C. And so I think, you know, there's something there. We may never understand the full extent of what may be going on in that dressing room. And, you know, good teams don't allow that stuff to fester or at least boil over into the public domain. But at the same time, you know, you're seeing stuff on the ice that, you know, where players are not coming to the aid of someone else who maybe, you know, it's after the whistle, there's a scrum. Too often this team has turned a blind eye to something that's happening to a teammate. And, you know, there are a lot of people who think, you know, standing up for yourself means fighting. Not necessarily, right? I mean, there are other ways to send a message to another team that you will not be physically, you know, manipulated out there. And the Oilers all too often just seem as if they just kind of want to avoid conflict. You know, and that doesn't sit well in a city that's, you know, I think Edmonton probably could, to some degree, stomach the futility, not 12-game or 11-game losing streaks. But what they might be able to get behind this team if it looked as if there was more a higher level of commitment and caring. You know, that losing appears to be a little too easy for this team. I think that troubles people.
And, you know, you talk about not sticking up for your teammates, and I thought that was on display here in Winnipeg this week a couple of occasions. I counted four or five when the opportunity was there for somebody to stick up for a teammate, and the player simply skated to the bench or just skated to the faceoff dot. And final question for you, Dave. Yep. Where does Dallas Eakins fit in all of this? I mean, you know, the pressure obviously on the head coach, because he's the head coach of a team that can't win a game, and his record since he's been there has been abysmal. But obviously the players on the roster, we've broken that down, the roster isn't very good, and the management is responsible for putting the roster on the ice. So what is the thought about Eakins in the Edmonton market right now?
Well, I think there were a goodly number of Oiler fans who thought that Eakins would be out yesterday. But Craig McTavish has made it very clear that Dallas Eakins is his hire, and that Taylor Hall, and this was widely reported, went to Craig McTavish recently and said it is not the coaching, it is on the players. He has not lost the room, he being Dallas Eakins. So, you know, unless people are not telling the truth here, those conversations have happened, and you know, all of this is terrific lip service, and everyone seems to be at this point saying the right things, but the results still aren't coming. And Sunday night against San Jose, I mean, San Jose's not San Jose, you know, your daddy's San Jose. They're not at that level, but they're still a pretty good team, and they're in the West Division, and we're a Western Conference, and Edmonton has yet to win against the Western Conference, so. You know, but Dallas Eakins said that statistic was not that important, and there were a lot of people that would beg to differ with him.
I think there'd be a lot of people that would beg to differ with him. Dave,
yes.
I mean,
especially when you're in the Western Conference.
Yeah. When that's where you do your business, you better find a way to win in that conference. Yeah, I think a lot of people feel the same way.
Yeah, they'll be the only team that can go winless in the Pacific Division and in their minds still think that they're going to be playoff eligible or something.
Exactly.
Dave Jamieson is with our TSN radio affiliate in Edmonton, TSN 1260. Dave, we appreciate your time as always. Thanks for joining us to talk about the Oilers and the Craig McTavish press conference from yesterday.
Thanks, guys.
Take care, Dave. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll move from the gong show of the Edmonton Oilers to hockey royalty that we lost this week in Jean Beliveau. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live at St. Vitale Center, Toy Mountain, in support of the Salvation Army, live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online TSN 1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard. Don't be an Ezzy. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center at 204-487-2226 or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Gentlemen, earlier this week, of course, the hockey community, the hockey world, mourned the passing of Jean Beliveau at the age of 83. Hockey royalty, you know, sort of personified in Mr. Beliveau, 17 Stanley Cups, a number which is somewhat unfathomable. We're going to talk about Jean Beliveau, but first, Yvon Cornoyer was a guest on Saturday Spotlight, I believe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and Yvon Cornoyer played with Jean Beliveau, and this is what he had to say about Jean Beliveau.
Oh, you just close your eyes, and you put your stick on the ice, and the puck comes. I mean... Jean was—he was a little bit older when I arrived, but I played with Jean about 6-7 years. So I always said I play with the old guys. I win half of my Stanley Cup with the old guys, and after that, the young guys came like Guy and Larry Robinson and Serge and Lemaire and Ken Dryden. So I was very fortunate to be right in the middle of those two. But Jean Beliveau is the. I think he's the only guy after a goal he scored in Chicago, I went up in the bench and I applaud.
Wow.
He just took Glenn Howell right out of his net. And Jean was a big man those days, and he had a reach, a very long reach, and Jean was so intelligent with the puck, so that was unbelievable.
That's Yvon Cornway, a 10-time Stanley Cup winner, only putting him 7 behind John Beliveau. 10-time Stanley Cup winner, speaking on Saturday Spotlight with Richard from a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the tributes that you saw pouring in this week for John Beliveau, I think say more than pretty much, that tells you all you need to know about what kind of man John Beliveau was.
Well, you know, Drew, we weren't fortunate to see him play at that time, but I think what the reaction that you've heard to the unfortunate passing of John Beliveau is how much respect everybody had for him. And I think the reasons for the respect is the way he handled himself and against his competitors and with his teammates. And one of the things that stood out for me hearing about John Beliveau and we really seeing him as a veteran that the Habs always were honoring and sitting behind the bench and such is, you know, how the stories of how he treated people when the spotlight wasn't on him, when he didn't, you know, considering who he was and the stature and the stories you hear about other people who are in those positions and don't treat people the same way. He treated everybody with respect, whomever they were, whatever their situation, and no matter if he thought somebody would find out about it or not. And that's a testament to his character. And to me, hearing so much about John Beliveau, the hockey accomplishments are secondary. That's what I took from it.
And his hockey accomplishments are ridiculous.
Yeah.
You're talking about a legend, and all of these words and all of these tributes to John Beliveau are 100% deserved. And I know Michael Farber had a really good piece for TSN. I really liked the piece that Ken Dryden did for the Toronto Star.
Red Fisher.
Montreal Gazette. There were many nice tributes to John Beliveau, but Richie, you hear about, and you know, you mentioned, you know, he played from 1955 to 1971 before we were born, but John Beliveau is the Montreal Canadiens.
Yeah.
He really is. And you mentioned his character, and that really is how he is defined, and it's incredible. Over the years, John Beliveau has always been at the Bell Center, and you equate him with the Montreal Canadiens, and you hear about him signing all the autographs. He never turned a kid down for an autograph. He was always readily available, and to me, you know, it's very sad that he passed away. And you know, something interesting too that I found that, you know, in Ken Dryden's piece is that when John Beliveau came into the league, Montreal Canadiens only had 7 Stanley Cups, and it was really around that time when they became the dominant franchise, and now they have the 24 Stanley Cups.
Well,
so he was highly responsible for that.
I love the story that the Montreal Canadiens, first of all, the fact that the Montreal Canadiens wanted him so desperately that they ended up buying the entire league because he was playing in Quebec City because he felt he owed it to the fans of Quebec City where he got his start, that he was playing for the Quebec Aces, and the Montreal Canadiens wanted him so badly, so desperately on their team, they felt that the best option was just to buy the entire league. I mean, wrap your brain around that. It's hard to.
And, you know, you talk about hockey royalty. He's just Canadian royalty.
That's true.
He really is. And you talk about the legends of the game, and, you know, Gretzky's in there, Bobby Orr's in there, and John Beliveau was before that. You know, Gretzky looked up to Gordie Howe, obviously, and all of the players. This is the guy. Like, John Beliveau is the guy, and especially to Montreal and the province of Quebec. And as I mentioned, you know, it's going to be sad to not see him at the Bell Center because over the years, as Richie mentioned, you always saw John Beliveau watching the Habs, still heavily involved with the Montreal Canadiens, of course. After his playing career, he was an ambassador.
Sure.
But, you know, it's really sad. All of the accolades, that's one thing, but, you know, the class is the word that is used a lot. And
grace and dignity.
Absolutely.
And the Canadiens will first play at home since his passing Tuesday night against the Canucks. That'll be certainly, I mean, the Montreal Canadiens do pomp and circumstance better than almost any franchise in sports. And where they're going to do it when their heart and soul has passed away, I think it's going to be a special night, certainly Tuesday night at the Bell Center. Here's some audio. It's a bunch of different TSN personalities reminiscing about Jean Beliveau.
L'incomparable numéro 4, Jean Beliveau.
I admired everything that Jean Béliveau did, that he stood for, and that he was such a great player for the Montreal Canadiens. His greatness was so evident and so obvious.
You think about Jean Béliveau, what you can only think about is royalty. He was elegant. He was elegant on the ice. He was elegant off the ice.
For me, he's the most stately, elegant, respected, and revered man in hockey, bar none. And I really believe that.
Unlike any of the other great players, what he did after the game, how he carried himself, almost dwarfed his accomplishments on the ice. We remember Béliveau as a person, not as a hockey player.
Jean Béliveau, that was Craig Button, Bob McKenzie, and Michael Farber speaking about Jean Béliveau and the Montreal Canadiens. Let's head to break. When we come back, Brian Engblom is going to join us. He obviously played for the Montreal Canadiens, won a number of Stanley Cups there. We'll talk to him about Jean Béliveau. We'll also talk to him about the Winnipeg Jets, as you, of course, know him best now as the Winnipeg Jets, one of the analysts on TSN3. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live at St. Vitale Center. We're in the food hall. It's Toy Mountain in support of the Salvation Army here on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
You're back on TSN 1290. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live at St. Vitale Center. We're in the food hall in support of Toy Mountain and the Salvation Army. Bring us a new unwrapped toy. There's a number of raffles. You'll be entered into the chance to win some great prizes. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. We're at facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, you know him from TSN Jets, analyst Brian Engblom. Brian, good afternoon, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Doing very well. How about yourself, Brian?
Good. Everything's great. Yeah, it's a nice day here in Denver.
That's good. Glad to hear that. It's actually a nice day here in Winnipeg as well, so we must be on the same weather wavelength or something.
Yeah, really?
Brian, we wanted to bring you on. We're going to talk about the Jets in a little bit. Wanted to start, of course, going back to your time in Montreal with the passing of Jean Béliveau earlier this week. You played for the Montreal Canadiens, of course, and you won 3 Stanley Cups with the Habs. You know, what's your sort of predominant memory being a member of the Montreal Canadiens and Jean Béliveau?
I think you pretty well everybody has read, you know, some of the familiar words that describe Jean Béliveau. You know, there was an elegance about him, there's dignity about him. He had like a senatorial presence about him. And at the same time, very kind and great humility. I mean, just a really, really genuinely nice man. Booming, deep voice. He should have been in radio. he had a terrific voice. And he was just a gentleman all the time. When he would come in the room from time to time, especially, you know, in the cup years, he'd come in and shake everybody's hand. And every once in a while, he'd come in the room after a game, after a win. You know, in those days, after a loss, nobody came in the room. You know, we were expected to win all the time because the league was so much different then. But he'd come in and, you know, shake your hand and just say hello. And it had such an impact on me. And I know it did even guys like Serge Savard and Guy Lapointe and Larry and those guys and Kenny Dryden, because he was who he was. He was the great Jean Béliveau. You know, I've heard that and seen that word used in front of his name all the time because it fits. Terrific man. Always funny. Always had time for everybody. Always stop and say hello. Never seemed to be in a hurry. And that was whether it was fans or whether it was us or, you know, whoever it was, somebody had stopped him on the street. So, he was fabulous. He had some really interesting things about his career, too, guys. Did you know that the first game he ever played in the NHL was an All-Star game?
Well, I did not know that.
Because he got signed from the Quebec Aces, and he didn't really want to leave Quebec City. I mean, they called the Quebec Colisée the house that Jean built because of Béliveau. Everybody came to watch him play. And the Canadians had to basically buy the league in order to get him as their property and convince him to come to Montreal and play for the Canadiens, because he was making pretty good money, I think, back in the day playing for the Quebec Aces. And so back in the day, the cup-winning team would play an all-star team. And the day that basically, I think he signed the day before, and then the first game he ever played was an all-star game. So that is about as unique as it gets. And then he won the first Conn Smythe trophy ever as well, 1965, very first year that they have it. You look it up, John Beliveau is the guy who won it. So his numbers speak for himself too, and is elegant and kind and everything and stately the way he played. I think he had 1,000 penalty minutes too in his career too. So he didn't mess around. You know, I mean, he was a hell of a player, and he just commanded so much respect when he came into the locker room from all our guys. And hey, I played with 10 Hall of Famers that in our team at the late in the late 70s there with the 4 cups in a row. There are 10 guys in the Hall of Fame there, so they had some pretty good prestige themselves. So when Jean walked in the room, they took notice and they stood up. That's one of the great things about the Canadians. There's a tremendous hierarchy that's been there. And I hope it's still there because I'm not around there all the time. But it certainly was. There was a presence in the room. Yvan Cornouaille was the captain when I came in. And he held himself a certain way. And then Savard was after that. And he held himself a certain way because you work your way up the food chain there. And Jean Beliveau was right at the top of the food chain.
And Brian, you talked about that. We were fortunate enough to have Yvan Cornouaille on the show a couple weeks ago and talking about playing with Jean Beliveau. And you talk about that hierarchy, the idea that those players like Cornouaille can play with a guy like Beliveau and then play on the teams that won and your teams in the 70s. And is he able to see, like, if he's in the dressing room during your time there, did he express, you know, the experiences with guys like Beliveau and use those to help the teams that you were on?
Oh, absolutely. All that information and that knowledge of how to conduct yourselves and how to play on the ice and off the ice, all those things were handed down at that time. And it came from guys like Beliveau. I mean, when a guy's won 10 Stanley Cups, you know, and winning teams year after year, you'd be an idiot not to listen and not to watch and do what they do. You know, and then Henry Richard had 11 Stanley Cups, and Henry was around a lot too. And he had this great stature about him as well. So we were surrounded with it. Rocket Richard, you know, passed a while ago. He wasn't around quite as much, but same thing. You're talking about the great Rocket Richard, the great Jean Beliveau, the great Henry Richard, and on and on and on. So it was a marvelous place to play with people like that around all the time. And Toe Blake used to travel with us in the playoffs because he was a mentor to Scotty Bowman, our coach. So Scotty would have him come on the charters with us and travel during the playoffs. And so he was around all the time, too. So it was fabulous.
Wow.
Brian, on the ice, what made Jean Beliveau such a special player?
Well, his skill, I remember this before the curve stick, so you're talking about a different era when he first came in the early 50s. I don't think the curve stick started until the early 60s. So, you know, they weren't shooting the puck the same way for a while. It was a lot wrist shot, dead straight sticks. I mean, the stuff that they use, you know, compared to now, it's like the Flintstones. And, you know, it's incredible how much the equipment has changed since then. So he was just a masterful stick handler and could pass the puck, you know, vision, all the things we still talk about players today. And he had a great toughness about him. I mean, he was 6'4", about 215, and he had a grace and elegance. He was such an easy skater, but his work ethic and all those things that we talk about with great players now, he had all of that. And on top of it, as I said, I mean, he wasn't exactly a polite player, getting 1,000 minutes and penalties, I believe is what I saw, on top of the 1,200 points, and would he have 125 playoff games or whatever. So, and back then, obviously, they only had a couple of rounds in the playoffs, so it just shows you how often he was there and how often they went to the and won the Cup 10 times.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Brian Engblom. We had been talking about Jean Beliveau. We're going to transition, of course, to the Winnipeg Jets now. Brian, of course, is an analyst on TSN 3, the broadcaster of the Jets here in Winnipeg. Brian, you know, Jets defensive injuries are adding up. We know earlier this week, Zach Bogosian out, Toby Enstrom out, Grant Klitsam out. How do you think the Jets are going to be able to withstand this rash of injuries for the next month to 6 weeks?
Yeah, it's going to be really difficult for sure, because those guys, especially Enstrom and Bogosian, are huge minute munchers, and they're up against top lines every night. So that right there, that's a huge obstacle to overcome. They're fortunate that they can drop, you know, Bufflin back there, and I know that's a controversial thing, and you know, there's a reason he's played forward all year, but Buff's got tremendous skills. And because he knows the team, he knows the game, he knows the system, it's a lot easier for them to drop him back than to, you know, bring up two guys from the American League and get them fitting in. Having said that, they've got Sherratt there. They're going to have to use people from the American League. every team in the league virtually is having to do that, guys. They're, you know, this injuries are such a big part of the game now, and it's really about treading water. They're in a good spot. They won a big game against Colorado last night without those guys, and really outplayed the Avalanche soundly. Mm-hmm. They certainly deserved that victory. So their system, I think, is so ingrained in them and is so good now. It's so different than last year and the years before. That structure will help them, and their goalies are going to have to be really good. There's no doubt about that. You know, that's the saving grace when you're going through a tough time. If your goalie's not one of the injured guys, they're going to have to play their tails off because it's going to be different out there, and they're going to give up more situations. So, I don't have a prediction for you. I don't know how well they're going to do, but I know that they are much more solid position to be able to go ahead in this situation than they were last year or in any previous years of the Jets. And you have to admire that. And it started last night, and they look darn good doing it.
When you talk about how ingrained the system is in the Jets, and I totally agree with that, and how many tight games they're probably going to play because they're playing such a defensive system at times, how important is the power play going to be? And if there is anything that has obviously struggled so far this season, is there any tweak that you would make from an outsider's perspective, following the team as closely as you do, that you think might work to get this thing going a bit?
Yeah, I you know what, I think they've tried just about everything. You know, if I had the formula for fixing power plays, I could make a lot of money. Because even the best ones, even Tampa and Pittsburgh, you know, they go on tough stretches and they can't seem to get it done. There's so much, you know, video of what the tendencies are. You have to keep changing it. Whatever was working is not going to work because there's smart people in the NHL, good players. They're going to take it away from you. So no matter what works for a game or two, or maybe even five games, is not going to work after that because teams are going to study up on it and say, okay, whatever happens, we're not letting them do that, you know, play X. So you have to change all the time. But to me, I think it's not overpassing for sure. And you have to put the passes on the tape. If you don't pass properly, you're screwed because the great penalty-killing teams, and the Jets are one of the best, you go with the pass. And if the guy bobbles it, you swallow him up. You get on him right away. And then, you know, then that guy is kind of, you know, just dumping it somewhere because he doesn't want to get checked and turn the puck over. So then, it's one bad pass after the other after the other. If the first passes aren't any good, you're screwed. So that's the most important thing. That and obviously shooting the puck at some point soon and get the puck to the net. Past that, as I said, you know, you try everything, it'll work for a bit, but bottom line, you're going to have to change it down the line anyway. Pass the puck well, and when you get your shots, take it and crash the net. That's the good old-fashioned way.
Brian, we got one last question for you here. I wanted to ask you about the Colorado Avalanche because in addition to doing an analysis for NBC and TSN, you cover the team for Altitude, and we're 27 games into the season here, and the Avalanche are 8 points out of a playoff spot. I guess from your vantage point, what's the biggest problem with this team, and can they turn it around and get into the playoffs this year, do you think?
Well, they were pretty full of themselves last year, and for good reason. They were the marvel of the league, really, in many ways. They win the division. Nobody saw that. They started off the season winning 12 of their first 13 games, and the chances of that happening again were zero, less than zero. They rode that momentum all year long. Even when they had slight losing streaks, that set them up so well, a young team with talent, that they never lost that feel. And let's face it, momentum and feel and confidence is so much about it. So this year they started off in the tank and played terribly. They were making some adjustments in their own end, and it showed. Their goaltending was mediocre, so they had no momentum. And on a young team in today's game, that, you know, it snowballed. They became terrible in their own end. They've changed their system again. Now they're starting to look like a team that knows what they're doing, and so they will move forward. But on top of that, they lost their game that they were playing last year because the NHL just won't let them do it. They play a speed game. They want to play 100 miles an hour all the time. Nobody will let them do it. And because of that, they've had to go to plan B, and there was no plan B. So they've lost their patience. They're still overpassing the puck, trying to make great plays that worked for them last year. And you got to grind it out. They have to learn how to grind, and they still don't quite get that. They're getting there, but they got to learn how to grind in more situations in order to win games. So it's been a complex myriad of problems, and one thing leads to another. I think they're getting out of it, but the chances of them making the playoffs already are pretty dim because they're so far down. It's not impossible, but it's getting there.
Brian Engblom covers the Winnipeg Jets for TSN 3. He covers the Colorado Avalanche for Altitude Sports, and he covers the NHL for the NBC Sports Network. Brian, appreciate your time, and thanks for sharing your reminiscences of Jean Beliveau with us.
Oh, it was great. Thanks very much for having me, guys. Enjoy.
Take care, Brian. Thanks very much, Brian.
Take care.
Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live at St. Vitale Center. We're in the food hall. When we come back, we'll do a score update from around the NHL today, and we'll talk about Daniel Alfredsson and his retirement. One final segment to come. You're listening to TSN 1290.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the St. Vitale Center Food Hall. This is TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Pleased to be broadcasting for one final segment. It's Toy Mountain in support of the Salvation Army. Following us, Matty Leibel, Brandon Ruicki, Troy Westwood, a special edition of the Big Show, special Saturday edition of the Big Show. So you still have until about 6 o'clock tonight to come on down and drop off your new unwrapped toy. Everything goes towards the Salvation Army. Maybe puts a smile on somebody's face who otherwise might not be able to afford to have a great holiday season. Of course, for your participation, we enter you into a number of different raffle draws, a chance to win some great prizes here at St. Vitale Center. Anyways, we're here till 6 o'clock. We're here for another couple minutes. Wanted to talk about Daniel Alfredsson. His official retirement happened earlier this week in Ottawa. I thought it was a really nice ceremony that the Ottawa Senators put on for Daniel Alfredsson, and it was nice to see that whatever sort of animosity existed in between the Sens and Alfredsson after he went to Detroit for that 1 year has been put to bed, and they were able to salute him and give him the ovation that he deserved, because he really is the Ottawa Senators manifestation in one player.
Yeah, and you talk about John Beliveau and him really being identified with the Montreal Canadiens. Daniel Alfredsson is identified as, he's captain senator. I mean, he really is, and all of those years when they had better teams, obviously they're doing a lot better than they were last year, guys, but you know, Daniel Alfredsson, you know, the talk is going to, you know, center around, you know, is he a Hall of Famer? Well, he doesn't have a Stanley Cup so and all that, but Daniel Alfredsson was a really good player for a really long time. And this is a guy that was a really good leader for a very long time. And I think the Ottawa Senators, Richie, have had a leadership gap since Daniel Alfredsson has left. And then, obviously, Jason Spezza was only captain for 1 year, going to the Dallas Stars in the offseason. But you know, Daniel Alfredsson, too, again, a really classy guy.
Yep.
And it didn't bother me at all. And we talked about this you know, last year. It didn't bother me at all that he went to the Detroit Red Wings. I mean, there was some disagreement there about money. And he wanted to chase a Stanley Cup. And I thought, I agree with you, Drew. I think it was really nice that he was able to sign a one-day contract and finish his career as an Ottawa Senator, which, you know, he's, you know, when a baseball player is, you know, gets into the Hall of Fame, he goes in as a certain team.
Yeah.
He was obviously going to go in as an Ottawa Senator.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was really classy. I let him get out there for the skate, too. Let the crowd salute him. And better than a press conference or anything like that. Only a press conference, because the fans who have been going to all the games in Ottawa or the diehards getting a chance to give him that final ovation. Get him to experience that, you know, to retire as a result of injury, which is really what happened here. It's always difficult on the player, but he's in a good enough shape to get out there and skate. And he meant so much to that team, Drew. I mean, he was there from the beginning when they were a franchise that was aimless to this, you know, the Hossa Alfredsson group that fell short of expectations. Frankly, it was good enough to have at least gone. They went to one cup, but they Stanley Cup final. But in reality, they should have won a cup or two, probably talent wise, and they didn't. And maybe that'll be looked at in terms of his legacy. And he did win an Olympic gold medal. And to be honest, I thought in the year that they lost the cup to Anaheim, he brought it more than any player on that Ottawa squad in the final. Like, when they were down in Anaheim, they were on a penalty kill, scored a shorthanded goal. I think it was in game four. Like, he was bringing it. He brought it every night, and the team certainly took his lead. And if they would have taken his lead even more than they did, some of the players, I think they probably would have some stuff on the mantle.
I like that he admitted to firing that puck at Scott. Was it Scott Niedermayer?
Of course he did.
I know, but he admitted to it after. You know, now that he's retired, he came out and it was one of the first things he said. He's like, yeah, I shot the puck at him. I was aiming for him.
Well, Daniel Alfredsson, you're talking 1,200 plus games. You're talking 400 plus goals. I mean, almost a point a game, 1,000 plus points.
Yeah, 1,157 points in 1,246 NHL games.
You know, Richie brought up that he didn't, well, we both brought it up, but talking about 2007. Going up against the Anaheim Ducks there.
Anaheim was a better team that year. It was years prior that they had better
teams. No, but what I'm saying is I agree. To me, that was Daniel Alfredsson at his best. And he was a little bit older, you know, early 30s at that point. 22 points in 20 games that year. I mean, he was that year. I remember that. I mean,
Overtime winner.
It was about 7 years ago, but I remember that. I mean, you're talking, he was a Conn Smythe candidate that year. That's how good he was. And, you know, he had many good regular season years and, you know, 100-plus playoff games. So, I mean, you're talking about an excellent hockey player, a great leader. And, you know, I think you can have those water cooler debates whether he's a Hall of Famer. I would probably say, yeah, he probably might be a Hall of Famer.
I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but I have great respect for his career, and he probably scored the biggest goal in Senators history, which was that overtime winner against Buffalo in the
Conference Finals. If he's not a Hall of Famer, he's darn close.
He's darn close. Yeah, I think he's darn close. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but I think he's darn close.
In terms of the Ottawa Senators, they actually played this afternoon. They fell 3-2 to Pittsburgh when you look at the out-of-town scoreboard, a couple afternoon games in the NHL. So Pittsburgh beat the Senators 3-2 today. And then as well in Long Island, the St. Louis Blues are currently up on the Islanders. I believe it's now 6-4, if I'm not mistaken, for... It's a final. We have a 6-4 final for the Blues over the Islanders. Jake Allen actually got chased from that game. Marty Brodeur comes in relief, and I believe he'll pick up the win for, yeah, he's the goalie, I believe, of record for the St. Louis Blues.
He already has the record for most career wins, so he's just...
he's adding one with a different
team. He's just adding more. So.
Other than the New Jersey Devils.
Well, it's going to be, Richie, when the interesting part's going to be when Brian Elliott comes back.
We didn't even address that today. I just don't know why they brought him in there. It seems like an unnecessary distraction to me.
Bringing in Brodeur.
Yeah.
They brought him in for that win.
So that they can say, they can be an answer to a trivia question of what other team is Marty Brodeur get a win for.
It does speak to, though, again, Rick and I were speaking about it last night, how good this Central Division is. Every time you turn your head, there's 2 points gone.
Richie, what's more bizarre, Gretzky on St. Louis or Brodeur on St. Louis?
I think Brodeur, because Gretzky played on the Rangers and Kings as well.
I agree, though. It's a little bizarre.
Let's finish it up. Let's go with cheers and jeers to finish the show.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something like this.
Surprisingly not good.
I think I speak for my colleagues Richard and Ezra when I say that we're going to make a unanimous cheer today. It goes out to Jean Beliveau. We just spoke about him with Brian Engblom. He passed away earlier this week at the age of 83. Really, the definition of hockey royalty. 17 Stanley Cups, 10 as a player, 7 more as an executive, and even more so than his on-ice and hockey-related accomplishments. It's the dignity and the class that he carried himself with. Nobody had a bad word or had a bad situation that they could ever speak to with Jean Beliveau, and that speaks more than anything about how important he was to the world of hockey. That's it for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show this Saturday. We're live here at Toy Mountain at St. Vitale Center. Want to thank the St. Vitale Center and the food hall here. Want to thank Scotiabank. Want to thank the Salvation Army. Big thank you to our sponsors, Bernstein's Deli, Linden Market Dental Center, and Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is illegalcurve.com. For Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Narv on site, and for producer Chris back at TSN 1290 Studios, thanks for listening. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned for the big show here on TSN 1290.
You've been listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.